Let's talk self-care. Today I'm talking with Robin Brennan, and she's going to talk about self-care specifically for parents of neurodivergent children. I want us to keep three things in mind: keep it simple, reset, and focus on the next steps, not always the big picture. As a mom of three and one that has had to support and advocate for their child, this is a really big thing to learn, to know. Self-care does not always have to be a big adventure. It doesn't have to be something that's overwhelming or takes a lot of planning. You're going to learn in this episode, so stick tight, how to use micro moments of self-care to help make it a better day. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. If you're a new parent to special education or a seasoned parent sitting at the IEP table, thank you for joining us. And today I'm talking to Robin Brennan, and she again is going to talk about self-care. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am a mom and special educator. I have sat on both sides of the IEP table as a parent and a professional. Over the last 25 years, I've made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and create killer support plans. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you're new to our podcast, give us a like and a follow. If you need more special education support, visit learningessentialsedu.com, where we provide that individualized, systematic approach to supporting students. You know your kids best. You know if they're struggling or thriving, if they are happy or losing hope, if they understand or they're completely lost. The question is, what now? If you're unsure what steps to take to help your child succeed and need a starting point, take our free quiz, learningessentialsedu.com. After answering some simple questions about your child, it will guide you towards the first step in helping your child be the best they can be. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Robin, welcome and thank you for joining us. I am excited to talk today about self-care for parents of neurodivergent children. And I hope that if you are a parent or a professional supporting parents, that you are listening in to see how we as parents or professionals can do a better job at self-care, which seems like a daunting ask. So I'm excited to chat with you today to make it more or less daunting, I should say.
Well, that's a great hope for today's conversation, right? To make it less daunting, because what parent couldn't use better self-care?
Yeah.
But parents of neurodivergent children, especially, because there's so much more that needs to be done in terms of scaffolding and supporting advocacy with schools, connecting up with other programs and activities that are a fit, all the trial and error that goes into that. There's so much on the to-do list of parents of neurodivergent kids, and it seems like self-care goes at the bottom.
It does. It does. And I'm going to, before I add my two cents to that, can you introduce yourself and let folks know how you came about to making this your priority to help strategize for parents and professionals?
Yes, absolutely. So of course, we all have a backstory, right? I am a marriage and family therapist by training. So I went to graduate school to become a couples therapist or a family therapist. And what ended up happening was my first job right out of graduate school was treating children. And I learned so much in that environment. It wasn't what I had originally planned on doing, but I absolutely fell in love with it. And a few years into that, had my own children. So my children are now 16 and 11. Both with ADHD, one with some pretty significant learning differences. And so on my own parenting journey, I've been paying attention to the emotional side. That's where having a therapist background is really, really helpful. Highly recommend. Go to graduate school, get some training as a therapist. It'll serve you well. But truly, having that eye on it and noticing what it was doing to me emotionally and what my needs were and where my needs were getting lost in the mix has really helped me to understand first, what that feels like for other parents and what that experience is like, but also to figure it out. I'm a problem solver by nature. I want to know, how do we get this right? And so digging in and doing that for myself and figuring out how to strike a balance and meet my own needs and the needs of my kids at the same time has just been crucial for me. So I bring that to work with me.
Well, I instantly gravitate towards your story. And I've mentioned before on this podcast a little bit, but we have three boys. We also have 11 and a 17-year-old, and then we have a 14-year-old in the middle there. But our middle son is a brain cancer survivor. And so similar, my undergrad is in regular ed. And then my first job was teaching special education. So then I pursued that as a master's and have taught special education since then. But I resonate with this in this podcast and our discussion today because of my son and having to advocate for him and his needs. And it's overwhelming. And you have that therapy background and lens, and I have a special education background and lens, and it's really hard. And so I'm hoping that through what we talk about today can help give hope and support for families that may not have the lens of either of what we have, but through our experience to be able to have better tools, so to say, in their toolkit. So before we kind of get into that, what are some common emotional obstacles for parents of neurodivergent children?
There are so many, but I would say number one is probably feeling like we're the only one that can do it right for our child, right? Yeah. That, you know, our children have particular needs and we are with them all the time. And we've had to develop our own understanding in order to parent those children. And so our understanding of what our child needs is inevitably deeper than the understanding of everyone else that they come in contact with. And so that idea that we're the only ones that can get it right because we have so much more capacity is probably stumbling block number one.
So are these parents at more risk of facing kind of a mental health crisis?
That's a good question. Whether it rises to the level of mental health crisis, I think depends on a lot of individual factors and maybe how we're wired originally. But I think a crisis in terms of chronic anxiety, for sure, that worry of whether my child is going to be able to make it in the world with other people around them rather than me by their side. That fear of, will they ever get there when they're lagging a little bit behind what we see their peers doing or what we perceive that their peers are doing, whether or not their peers are actually able to do those things on their own. So I think that crisis of anxiety is a big one. And there's also that layer of, if I don't find the right services, we're going to waste our money. If I don't find exactly the right programs, my child is not going to be prepared for this or that. So there's that piece of, I have to study everything and know everything about everything. And then I'm still worried that that's not going to be enough, that my child is still not going to be okay.
Yeah. And you still have that other layer of other kids in your house. Well, you know, sometimes, right? You know, if you have other children and then you have, you know, multiple children that have, you know, and people have said, oh, you have three boys, they must have the same personality, regardless of any kind of impact. And I just laugh and I'm like, they're not even in the same book. They're like on different shelves in the library. Like they're just so different. And so then you have that layer and just being a parent. And so it gets complicated, right?
Yes, it gets complicated fast. It really does. And sometimes it feels like doing right by one child is doing wrong for the other or another.
Yeah. So there's a huge amount of responsibility for parents of neurodivergent children. Can you describe what you see this feeling like for parents? Like, is it healthy to communicate how burdened they may feel? Or, you know, who should they communicate to? Like, what does it look like and what should they kind of go for?
It's absolutely healthy to communicate what this feels like. It's tricky sometimes to find the right listeners. Other parents of neurodivergent children make great listeners in this situation, but it's also possible to have family members and other people around you arrive at enough understanding to really realize and recognize what it's like for you, but that requires your communication. if you don't share how difficult it is, they're not going to know. They're not going to make that assumption on their own. They're going to assume parenting for you is like parenting was for them or is for them. And that's not necessarily true. So the only way to have other people really understand and hear your experience is to communicate your experience. And when that doesn't happen, you end up feeling very burdened yourself. You end up feeling like everything is on your shoulders. You have to carry it all alone. That's a very isolating feeling. It's also really exhausting. And it can get to a place where you start to feel anger toward your child for having needs. When it gets to that place where you start to think to yourself, they're doing this to me, then it's a time to really have a professional be the one listening, to talk that through for yourself so that you can do some healing and move forward in a different way.
So how can a parent start that communication in a way that they feel that the person that they're speaking to is receiving that information? Like, how do you start that conversation about your child when you are probably struggling within yourself of how to navigate everything? And how do you start it with in a way that it's, you know, positive and healthy and not just let me give all this to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And as moms, oftentimes, and of course, we're talking to dads too in this conversation, but oftentimes moms are really great problem solvers. They jump in the moment and fix all the little nuts and bolts, right? Cut the crusts off the lunches and all those kinds of things. And so when you're talking to your mom friends, sometimes they're going to want to jump in and do all the problem solving and tell you to try this resource, or maybe you need sleep training or do this or do that. And so framing the conversation in a way that lets them know what you're looking for from them is really helpful. So saying something like, you know, we're going through some really tough stuff with so-and-so, your child, right now. And I would really, really love to just be able to share what that feels like. Can you listen for a moment? Like, can I tell you about that a little bit? Because it's feeling like a burden to me. It's feeling like I'm carrying it emotionally. And I would love to just be able to share it and have somebody know what we're going through. So being able to frame it like that, there's also another key piece in there. We're going through something, right? It's not that your child is a burden. It's that the situation is difficult, right? It's not that your child is a burden and it's not that you're failing at it. It's that the situation is difficult. You're going through something together as a family. And that's true of everyone in the family. Everyone in the family plays a role in handling what you're handling.
It's definitely a family system. How would you then talk to siblings about it? If there are siblings in the home and there's, you know, whomever is struggling, it impacts the whole family. So how do we communicate that to siblings?
Yeah.
In a way that makes sense to them.
Yeah. And that's going to depend a little bit on the age of the siblings and how much you're comfortable sharing. A lot of times families feel like something like an ADHD diagnosis is personal and not to be shared. And that gets really tricky because as a family, you're that inner circle. You have to know a little bit about what's going on there. You have to understand that there's a reason that someone does something a little bit differently than someone else. And so whether you use that specific language or not, whether you use the diagnostic language, it's really important to share, you know, it's because of how this person is wired that this is happening. However, we understand that it might be like this for you. Like, I'll give an example from my own life. So my older one, when frustrated, tends to scream, just like spontaneously, scream. That's really startling for my younger one. And so her experience in that situation is of being startled and being screamed at and being scared in the moment. And as her mom, I have to have some empathy for that and really support her in that. At the same time, that I'm saying, you know, we can work on the impulse control piece. We can really encourage this to be done differently, but he's going to make mistakes and he's still going to hit a moment of frustration where that scream comes out of him. And so empathizing with my younger one is about really being able to say to her one-on-one, you know, this is really hard. Tell me what it's like for you and how can I support you or help you in this situation?
Yeah. And that's, I think, incredibly important. And I know just for us when, so our son was in the hospital for 40 days and when we were about to leave, one of, I don't know if it was the oncologist or the surgeon or somebody, we were just thinking, oh my gosh, like, what do we do here? And they said, well, you still have to parent, right? Because you are like, you know, it's your baby and your baby, you know, and so you still have to parent. And so with that, and what you just said, are there some parenting strategies that you like to teach or share to help parents who have neurodivergent children?
Ooh, teaching emotional regulation from a young age is really important, but you do that by making your own emotional regulation visible. So when you're starting to feel yourself get tense in a situation, stopping yourself and taking that really nice, slow, deep breath. Sometimes, depending on how your child is wired, they may need you to explicitly point out that that's what you're doing. You may need to narrate it. They might not just pick it up in the ether like some kids do. And so you might have to be very specific, like, ooh, I'm feeling this tightness in my chest right now. I think that means I'm getting mad. I'm going to take a deep breath. Will you take it with me? And then you just take this nice, slow, deep breath. So you're teaching that it's okay to notice what's happening with you emotionally and stop the action in order to handle the emotion for a moment. And that's something that we really need to keep teaching our kids as they're growing. You know, later on, we want them to be able to do that on the playground before they hit somebody else, or, you know, in a job context when they're adults. We want them to be able to recognize what's happening in their body as cues of emotion and step back. And that can be really, really hard for our neurodivergent kiddos, especially. Sometimes there's some discomfort with interoception, with that sense of what's happening internally in your body, with feeling your own heart rate, your own temperature. Sometimes that feels overwhelming from a sensory standpoint. And so it's finding what those other things are for that child. Maybe when their heart rate goes up, they start fidgeting really fast and they can notice that rather than, you know, notice the heart rate piece. So very early on, it's about showing your own emotional regulation in a way that your child can see it and repeat it and copy it, right? So, you know, if you're starting to feel agitated in a conversation with your child, just being able to say openly, you know what, I feel my arms getting really tense. I feel my chest getting tight. I think that means I'm getting frustrated or annoyed or angry or upset. I better take a really good deep breath. And just take that deep breath. You can even encourage your child to take it with you. Our neurodivergent kiddos especially sometimes need us to point out explicitly what we're doing. Some kids will just pick that up from watching us and know, and other kids need it really spelled out and given to them step by step. And so adding the words to it, really narrating what you're doing, can help a child get the message in a moment like that. And then, of course, we want them to keep getting those messages as they get bigger and bigger. We want them to be able to check on their own body signals to prevent an explosion on the playground or even in the workplace as they get older. And we want them to be able to take that step back and do things that regulate them. Sometimes from a sensory standpoint, having that interoception, that internal body awareness, is uncomfortable. For some kids, I see that especially with some of our kiddos that are on the autism spectrum, that feels uncomfortable, the idea of monitoring their own heart rate or monitoring their own breathing. And so as you get to know your child, as your child is growing, you're to look for those external signals that that child shows in that moment. And you start to know, you know, okay, if we're fidgeting faster, that means that there's a higher level of emotion and we should pause and do this. So it might be something that they can notice their hands doing or their feet doing or notice themselves doing in some other way that can give them that body cue that they maybe need to step back and re-regulate before they get back into a situation.
I like that. And so then is there anything else in addition to emotional regulation that would support parenting strategies? And, you know, I know our focus is self-care, but I kind of want to just to lay a foundation of what this could look like as before we start hopping into self-care.
Yeah. So emotional regulation is the foundation of everything, right? Yours and your child's. So we've got to get that going first. Even when we have families coming to us for therapy, when they're coming for child therapy, we often start with parenting therapy. We almost always recommend starting with parenting therapy. And one of the first things we want to make sure parents have is their own reset button, their own way that they can re-regulate and then get back into a situation. Because if you don't have that, if you can't reset in between things like that, then you're just daisy chaining stressor to stressor to stressor to stressor all day long. And things get progressively more frustrating and more upsetting and more difficult to handle as you go. And so that emotional regulation piece is really, really the core of it. When it comes to parenting our neurodivergent kiddos, often they also need us to be teaching aspects of executive function. And that means looking at where your child is, where your child is struggling, getting really good information from professionals about that. So getting those assessments, getting the neuropsych assessment, getting the speech language assessment, getting those details that you need to really understand where the struggle is important. And then thinking about where you want your child to get to in terms of functioning, and then backing it way up to that first tiny little step. You know, often we're comparing where we are and where we want to be versus where we are and that next little baby step toward where we want to be. And so I think in terms of your parenting mindset, looking for that next tiny step, you know, I'd like my child to be better at self-advocacy. Maybe that starts with them asking for something at Starbucks or at a restaurant. Maybe that starts with them speaking up for themselves while we stand shoulder to shoulder with them. Or there are always small little ways that you can move one step closer to where you'd like to be. And as a parent, it's really crucial to keep your focus on what that next little step is, rather than that long-term milestone that you're headed for. Because if you're comparing all the time against the long-term, you're always going to come up short. Mm-hmm. And then your child is going to feel that too, right? They're going to feel like they're always coming up short. So narrowing your focus, I would say, is the other really critical parenting piece.
That's crucial. And I like that you do that, because it is hard to see the forest through the trees as a parent, of any type of parent, right? And so, you know, always constantly thinking of what's happening next, what's the future look like? And so for you to remind parents to kind of take smaller steps, almost like an IEP, right? You have your goals, you have your objectives, breaking it down. So
you know, I love that you said that, because in my language, it's a treatment plan. And I will say, I always have a treatment plan for my child. And that's what it is. It's that goal of the next little milestone.
Right. And then you have something to measure against, right? I mean, I'm not saying go collect data on everything for your kid, but you know, you have something to measure against of, you know, how are we going to get there? And I know for parents, we talk about their parent input statement for an IEP. And I always say, you know, because an IEP is a secular time, that doesn't mean that you're only thinking in 1 year at a time. I always say, you know, think 5 years, 3 years, 1 year, but also 6 months, 3 months, like, where do we want to go? And as a parent, that can be pretty overwhelming, right? In terms of that. So I think keeping that in mind in terms of just taking those smaller steps can be helpful to reduce that worry and that stress. But can you tell us from your point of view or definition of smart self-care?
Yes, absolutely. I want to add one thing to what you just said before I do that, though.
Please.
Something to measure against also means something to celebrate.
Yes.
When we add a milestone, we add something else that we can celebrate. And that's an opportunity for that child to have that sense of achievement. And for you as a parent to have a little bit of relief that we are moving forward. So that's really important, just having those tiny little milestones along the way, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So you were asking about sort of a foundational definition of what self-care is, right?
Yes.
Self-care is noticing your needs and finding ways to meet them.
I like that you had both points, because I'm sure parents are sitting here, whether they're driving, they're walking their dog, whatever, like, yeah, Robin, Wendy, that's great. I'm going to notice my needs. I notice them every day, but how do I address them?
Yes. Yes. And sometimes the noticing is the barrier, right? Sometimes we're moving so fast from thing to thing. I personally am not the greatest at noticing my own needs. I've had to learn how to do that in smaller chunks and step by step, because otherwise, you know, you don't notice your needs until you're crying on the floor. You don't notice your needs until you're screaming, and that's not serving you, and it's not serving your child either. And so developing that capacity to notice is really the first part. That probably means checking in with yourself on a daily basis, feeling how your body is doing, journaling if that's something that you do or that you're drawn to, finding those ways to check in with yourself and just notice, you know, where's my mood right now? How exhausted am I? How joyful am I? How excited am I? Do I have a balance of those things? Am I part exhausted, part joyful, and part excited? Or am I all in one camp today? And what do I maybe need to do about that? So of course, then that second part is action. What do we do about that? And I think there's one step in what do we do about that a lot of parents miss, and that's figure out how to have some time off the clock as a parent. It's harder to find babysitters when our kids have needs. It's harder to take that time away, again, because we feel like we're going to do a better job of it than somebody else. And that's probably true in a lot of cases. It's also okay for it not to be done perfectly. But finding ways to take time off. And that often means that each parent in the family needs to have a night off, a day that they're not responsible for the bedtime routine, or they're not responsible for the school pickup, where if something comes up, the skinned knees, the the frustrations, the meltdowns between kiddos, when those things come up, it's on the other parent to handle them. Right? If you're parenting with one adult in the household, then that probably means having some time where you have somebody come in to be on duty for a short period of time. And that might mean an extended family member. It might mean that you make friends with another parent and you can swap nights off. Somebody's responsible for all the kiddos on one night, and then somebody else is responsible on another night. But having that reliably scheduled time off is really critical. Otherwise, you are on duty 24/7. You are always on call. Whatever happens, it's you that jumps up to handle it. And sometimes in a two-parent household or even a three-parent household, that's both of you or that's all of you jumping up to do that. And it's not always necessary that it be all of you, right? And if it's just you, if it's always you, but there is another parent present there, that other parent is used to it always being you and isn't going to realize that it would be helpful for you to have somebody else jump in and do that unless you have some conversations about what you need and getting some time off for yourself. So time, you need a block of time that really just belongs to you.
And I would imagine that could be varying in lengths of time, yes, that you can schedule. And how you described it, it doesn't necessarily mean I have to pay somebody to come into my home, because that can always be a barrier in terms of having to pay a babysitter. But there are ways that we can reach out in the community to develop and foster relationships, or in your, you know, within your personal extended family, to establish a way to get a little bit of respite and have that respite care for yourself. Can you talk about the spectrum of self-care? What could that look like? And how do parents identify what self-care looks like for them? Because it may be a little bit different for each parent.
Absolutely. And I think we have some things on our blog about this that I'll have to give you links to as well, that you can maybe post so that people can find their way to some of these lists of ideas of what you can kind of do with your self-care time. Self-care might just mean showering slowly. Taking your time with those things that you do at the beginning of the day or the end of the day, and knowing that, you know, somebody else is on duty in that moment, is taking care of things in that moment. And you can take the time, you can put lotion on after your shower, or whatever it is for you, right? So sometimes it literally means that, just knowing that you're not going to be interrupted in something that is nurturing for you, that feels supportive to you, feels good to you. It can be as minor as that, or as major as you have an entire day off a week, that you are not on parenting duty on Thursday or Tuesday or whatever it is. And life happens, right? You're going to have moments where you're technically off duty, but one kiddo is homesick from school and the other one needs to be somewhere. There are going to be moments where you get pulled in, but those moments should be the exception, not the rule. So, you know, you can have that mindful shower routine. You can have a full day off. You can have anything in between. It can be, you know, between 4 and 5 p.m., mom is doing yoga, or, you know, dad is listening to his favorite podcast, or we're taking a walk, or we're doing something that just feels nourishing, rejuvenating. There's a word I'm looking for in here, like refreshing, something that's your reset is really what I'm looking for. So it can be a short amount of time, it can be a long amount of time. You can set it up in a way that works for you. It can even just be a little bit of extra time in your car after you drop the kiddo off somewhere, sitting in there and listening to music that feels really good for you. You know, you can match music to your mood. You can match music to the mood you want to be in. You can put on something upbeat and energetic when you feel the need for that boost in your energy, or you can put on something relaxing and calming when you're feeling like you're stuck in go, go, go mode and you can't slow down.
There is something powerful about being in your car. With, you know, just unattended in your car. I tend to listen to podcasts. That was shocking since we're recording a podcast, but there's something powerful about that, having my cup of coffee and just, you know.
Right. There's nothing sneaky about it. No. As parents, we feel like we're stealing that time. Like we're supposed to be doing something else with it. We're supposed to be folding laundry or making amazing organic home cooked meals or whatever it is.
Too much pressure.
Yes, it's too much pressure. It's absolutely too much pressure. And that time belongs to you, and having you grounded and well-regulated throughout the day does so much more for your child than any other task you could do. It really needs to float to the top of that priority list instead of the bottom.
Can you talk about the relationship between healthy self-care for parents and neurodivergent children?
Yeah. So this is a relationship that really easily gets out of whack. Because with neurodivergent children, we need to do a lot of scaffolding, right? We're supporting them in keeping track of their assignments. We're sometimes supporting them in finding their clothes in the morning and getting dressed. We're supporting them in remembering to finish eating their breakfast. Like there are so many things that we feel like we're on duty for as parents. So I think that balance is really about noticing when you're on duty for something and taking a few moments off duty to kind of balance that out. Noticing when what your child is needing is kind of taking over all of the time and there's no gap in there. That might mean a couple of things. It might mean that your child needs some more outside support to develop that skill that you need them to have in that moment, or that you're hoping they can have in order to be a little more self-sufficient in that moment. It might also mean that the ask is too big. We were talking about those baby steps forward in your child's development, especially their development of executive function. And sometimes we're scaffolding a lot because we're trying to get our child from where they are to five steps ahead of where they are instead of to one step ahead of where they are. So just attending to that, to how much you're filling yourself in to close the gap. Sometimes it's the gap in your child's functioning. Sometimes it's the gap in services that are being provided by school or somewhere else. The thing is, our kids will get there. They will get there on a different timeline. And so, you know, sometimes it's really hard to see that gap and to not be able to close that gap. But if you try to close that gap with yourself, with your time 100%, and you end up without time for self-care, then it's time to reevaluate that a little bit.
Can self-care occur while the parent is with their child?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sometimes it's as simple as taking charge of the radio station in the car. How many of us have switched over to what our kids want to hear and left it there? And then it becomes an expectation that, you know, things are always tuned to what your child wants. It's okay to say, you know what? I need a moment to recharge myself a little bit. I need to tune over to something that's fun for me, or that I enjoy listening to, or we need 5 minutes of silence right now so that I can breathe a little bit. Those things are okay. And self-care can happen in collaboration with your child, right? Sometimes you can do something together that's self-care for you both. That might mean taking a hike or walking the dog. It might mean doing something that's playful or silly. In our house, even though none of us are particularly good at it, we sing a lot. And so we will sometimes make up silly songs about things that are happening in the moment. And that makes us all laugh, right? Everybody contributes to it. It makes us all laugh. We used to have a rule when our kids were little that they could fight with each other, but it had to rhyme. And so that was a fun one for us as parents too. And they would, it slows them down enough that they're not just yelling off the top of their head. They're truly trying to make it rhyme with what their sibling just said to them. And that just, it turns it into family fun, right? It takes something that's stressful and makes it enjoyable. And that's really what self-care is about. Little moments of enjoyment, little moments of peace.
I think that's brilliant, making it rhyme.
Yeah. Feel free to use that one. If your kids are able to do that, feel free to use that one. A lot of neurodivergent kids do better when something has rhythm or rhyme to it.
I love that. I will definitely use that. I used to tell my kids when they complained that they could write a formal letter to the complaint department, and the complaint department would review it on Fridays at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
And they're open.
And you know what? That's self-care. That's self-care. It's putting a boundary on the amount of constant complaining that you're enduring. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So it can be 5 minutes. It can take 1 minute to breathe. It can to reflect. How do parents start working on self-care? How do we start putting that into our routine in terms of like making sure sometimes you need reminders for it, which sounds so silly, but like if you're feeling, you know, this unending busy schedule of nonstop of being on, you know, that protective mode or just being on parent mode and running the household and working and kind of navigating all this.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have this technology with us that helps us with reminders these days, right? We use it to help our kids with reminders. Hopefully, if you're reminding your child all day long, think about what Alexa or Siri or someone could be doing for you. But we can set reminders for ourselves. You can have an alarm that goes off on your phone that tells you it's time for self-care, just like your Apple Watch buzzes and it tells you to stand up, right? Or it tells you that, you know, you've reached your exercise goal or closed your loop for the day. You can set those kinds of reminders and those kinds of expectations for yourself around self-care as well. I think just like when we start looking at the progress we want for our kids, we measure in small increments. We should be measuring in small increments for ourselves too. Right? You don't have to go straight from having no self-care at all to all self-care all the time. It's okay to just start with something really minor. Sometimes that means adding something to your bedtime routine that just offloads your emotions for the day. could be journaling, could be meditating, could be exercise, could be singing, could be getting a foot massage from your partner. Something at the end of the day that feels like it's just for you.
Yeah,
and bedtime is usually an easy place to start that because we're kind of winding down and going through a routine at bedtime anyway.
And it doesn't have to be long or expensive. How do we make sure we are invested in the power of our self-care routine?
Ooh, it becomes self-reinforcing pretty quickly because you start to realize that you're your better self the rest of the time when you've got that self-care going. So again, watch the tendency to be judgmental of yourself on whether you're doing it or not doing it. We don't want to add this to that list of things that we feel pressured about. But you asked, I think, how we sort of keep it routine or keep ourselves responsible for it.
And yeah.
And that's sort of a mindset shift from how I normally think of it. I normally think of it as, you know, kind of like what you would do for yourself if you had tight muscles in your neck or in your shoulders. You might stretch a little bit, right? Like you notice it, it feels uncomfortable. You do something quick with it that just offsets it or balances it out. And it's that, it's noticing that little bit of agitation that you feel or that little bit of discomfort that you feel and doing something as simple as, you know, 30 seconds of stretching to offset that in the moment. So maybe it's just remembering that there's two steps to it, notice and do, right?
Yeah. Notice and do. And I think realizing that it doesn't have to be this huge thing every day. It can be these little micro steps that are going to help, would you say, make you a stronger parent, right? So does self-care equal a stronger parent then?
Yes, absolutely. Because more regulated parent is stronger parent. None of us are our best selves when we're frustrated, exhausted, and upset.
How does this give us self-empowerment?
Ooh, I think it puts you in touch with the power you already have. Right? It makes you aware that you have a little bit more control over your situation day to day than it feels like you do. There are a lot of things happening around you that are going to come at you.
Yeah.
But how you as a whole person address those things is up to you. And you really do have a lot of power and control there.
How could parents take this idea of self-care and work that into their advocacy for their child or work that into being a parent on an IEP table?
Ooh, that's where your expertise and mine come together, right? You need both of us at that IEP table with you. So some of it is about really knowing what you can and can't control in that circumstance, not coming in expecting that you're going to be able to change the world, but coming in expecting to be listened to about that one key piece that your child really needs, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think a little bit of self-care before you step into that meeting is really crucial. It's near impossible to bring your calmest self into that room, right? It's not going to happen. But you can make a valiant effort to bring your calmer self into that room. So taking some time to do some deep breathing, taking some time to really narrow your focus to what that one thing is you want to get out of that meeting, right? What is my message in this meeting? And really sticking to that message in the meeting feels like self-care as well. You're advocating for your child, and you're advocating for your child to get the peace they need from school or the peace they need from whatever other context it is. Because as parents of neurodivergent kids, we're also meeting with camp staff and talking to people who are running other kinds of activities to help them be ready for our child and to be able to help our child be ready for them.
I think it's an excellent way to say that. I encourage parents all the time prior to an IEP meeting. Well, first of all, you're coming in with this fear and love, right?
Yeah.
So it's intense. And you as a parent oftentimes don't feel like you're, although you should be part of that team, there's oftentimes I'm talking to parents that they don't feel that they're qualified, quote unquote, even though they are the parent of the child, to be a part of that team. And so I think prioritizing the concerns that you have and doing just that, what you had shared in terms of having a central message. So that gives you something to focus on. It gives you something to control, which I would believe you are the expert would help reduce that stress going in.
Yes. Yeah. It does reduce the stress going in. It's still going to be challenging in the moment. You're still going to have information brought up that you haven't seen before. There's going to be lingo used that's unfamiliar. That's the other piece of self-care in an IEP meeting. Ask questions. What does that mean? How does that connect to, you know, my child's ability to move on to middle school? Or how does that connect to this other goal that we've already set for my child moving forward? It's okay to ask a lot of questions in those meetings. You should be asking a lot of questions in those meetings. So know that too. Know that you don't have to know everything. You're not supposed to know everything. You're part of the team because of your expertise about your child and about what works for your child, not because you also have to be the classroom teacher and the school counselor and the special education pullout support, et cetera.
Are there any quick suggestions for professionals that are interested in improving self-care for either themselves or families that they support?
Self-care when you're supporting other families is equally crucial to when you're supporting your own family, but it's very, very tempting when you're a helping professional to take your client's stories home with you in your head, right? To keep thinking about how to help them and what to do to support. So I'm going to go back to narrow your focus. Remember what your one task of the moment is with that particular family, for that particular family. Where are we trying to go right now? And then when we accomplish that, we can go the next place. And also remembering that it's not yours to decide. It's not yours to manage. And that parent that you're working with is incredibly competent and is going to come up with some ways to do this that you wouldn't have thought of. And so you do have to leave space for that, for the parent to bring in their own expertise and put the puzzle pieces together.
What would be your, as we're winding down, what would be your three tips for parents?
So hard to boil it down to three. The first one is reset, reset, reset. Little bits of self-care all day long when you find yourself feeling agitated. So you're going to notice how you're feeling and you're going to do something with that. Something tiny, not something massive that takes all day. So I think that's that first one, right? Reset, reset, reset. Number two is keep your focus on the next step. Keep your focus on the next thing you're trying to accomplish, because the big picture can be really overwhelming, but the big picture is made up of all of these tiny little pieces and you're putting them in one puzzle piece at a time, right? And I think number three is, if you're finding yourself having a hard time prioritizing you or understanding what you need in this context, work with a therapist. We can really help you figure out where your stuck points are and what it takes for you to feel like you're doing your best parenting work and like you're living your best life with the circumstances that you have.
Is there anything that a parent should ask if they're hearing this and they're saying, yes, I know I need to work with a therapist? Is there anything, as they're trying to find a match, what would be your advice for a parent that says, you know what, I'm in this situation, I'm parenting a neurodivergent child, I'm not feeling like I am being the best version of myself? What type of therapist would somebody look for? Is there little tips that you have?
Yeah, so I think it's really helpful in that situation if a lot of your stress is being driven by the parenting piece. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But if a lot of your stress is coming from there, I think it's really helpful to work with a therapist who also works with neurodivergent children, someone who understands what that's going to look like and has some empathy for your process in trying to put all those puzzle pieces together on your own, right? So someone that has a little bit of that expertise, I think it's a little bit difficult to discern that. You really have to read people's websites to understand how much they have to say about a particular topic. But you don't want to just go with somebody who says, oh yeah, I treat ADHD. You want to know how and with whom and what's your expertise in helping parents in this situation. There are also, I think, a lot of practical tips that come with working with a therapist who is also treating neurodivergent children. There's a lot that goes into setting up a lifestyle day to day that's supportive of those kids. And so you want somebody who can help you kind of tease out those pieces of where can we create a little more efficiency? Where can we make this easier or more automatic so that mom or dad doesn't have to be involved every little step of the way? So you want somebody who can help you think through some of those practical aspects as well.
This has been incredibly informative, and you've just provided some excellent tips to get parents started and to kind of have that reframe. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners that I did not ask or know enough to ask?
I think when it comes to self-care, we want to keep it as simple as possible, right? Let's keep the messaging as simple as possible and keep the practice as simple as possible. It really comes down to little moments of nurturing yourself. And so keep the focus there. Don't feel like you have to add yoga and journaling and meditation and everything else to your to-do list. Just do it moment to moment in the moment when you notice you need to do it, right? And as you do that, you'll start noticing more and more, and you'll start being able to take those small actions more and more.
How can parents find you?
Predominantly through our website, which is betterfamilytherapy.com. We are actually, we're reworking some of our child therapy materials right now to focus more on the parenting side. Because what we've seen over time, as we're working with families who often come to us looking for child therapy first, once we start working more directly with the parents, that family tends to take a leap forward. And so we are flipping that around and saying, if you want to come to us for child therapy, we want you to come in as parents first and get that piece going first. And you may not even need us to meet with your child at that point. So you'll see that our messaging is changing in that way from what it has been, to really focus on what we've noticed is most effective for people. And then if you want to come in person and see us, our offices are in Kensington, but we're also available online.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I appreciate your time and your insight to this critical conversation, and I hope folks reach out, and we'll put all your information in the show notes. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you again for listening. My big takeaways from this podcast really are just that. Try to keep it simple. Work on emotional regulation for your child, for yourself. Pressing that reset button as often as needed. And again, it doesn't have to be something huge. It can be something little, simple as listening to your favorite radio station, walking outside around the block really quick. So thinking about ways that you can really be mindful of what is going on in your body as a parent, and then being able to put that into action. And again, it could be something quick, or it could be something big. Either way, also think about making a friend in the waiting room. If you have a child and you are there waiting for a service, whether it's physical therapy, occupational therapy, mental health therapy, chances are the parents that are sitting in that waiting room with you are going through something super similar. So make a friend in that waiting room. Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like or follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com. You can download how to prepare for an IEP meeting. You can also take our free quiz to help you go from worries to wins and to figure out the best support in helping your child and taking that first step. Hope this helps. Make it a great day. Bye for now.